Good evening. Hello. It is once again my pleasure to be joined by Stephen Singular, the author of Legacy of Deception, about the apparent framing of O.J. Simpson. The book was published in softcover by Dove Books, copyright 1995. Welcome back once again to our airwaves, Stephen.
Good to be here.
We've been talking about the information that was provided to you by a source within the Los Angeles legal system about the apparent framing of O.J. Simpson. One of the central points of evidence, one of the central bones of contention, I should say, concerns some swatches of blood that were apparently taken at the crime scene and yet may have been switched by way of a transition. Why don't you sum up briefly what that particular point of information detailed and Henry Lee's perspective on that during the trial.
Right. Well, as I had said earlier, I had gone to the defense in early August of 94 and pushed quite hard on this blood preservative theory and said that they should get their hands on the blood and they should test it, and had initially met resistance on this, but over time they began to look into it and take quite seriously. What happened is that we had sort of a parting of the ways over some of these other issues I was mentioning earlier, and I went back to Denver and decided to write a few pages of my experience and send it out to someone and see if they might be interested in having me write a book about this. I have written several books about true crime situations, and I sent it out here, and the information was leaked to all of the major players in the case. It went to the prosecutors, it went to the judge, and it went to the defense. And this, in my mind at least, has quite a lot of relevance to the case. Because what happened is that I had essentially outlined what the defense was going to present in their case when the trial actually started. And Chris Darden, in his new book, In Contempt, essentially says exactly the same thing, that he saw the book proposal in November of 94, and he said here was the blueprint for what the defense was going to do long before the trial started. It came from me before the information had become known or become public. The point of all of that is that in February of 1995, Rocky Harmon, who was a prosecuting attorney and a somewhat of a scientific blood expert, stood up in court and said to Judge Ito, look, there is this silly rumor going around that blood was planted in this case and that can be proven by a preservative being in the blood. This is ridiculous. We are going to disprove that. We are going to take it upon ourselves to disprove this theory definitively by bringing in the FBI and having them test certain parts of blood for EDTA. And we will, he in fact had written a letter to the FBI saying that that's what they wanted the FBI to do, to essentially shatter this theory. That's not exactly the way you would set up an objective experiment, but that was essentially the language that was used. So this became rather public at that time. Judge Ito said, great, let's get the FBI, let's get in here and do these tests. This was on February 3rd of 1995. I don't think it's a coincidence that having read the book proposal and studied it, and perhaps from other sources, they knew that the defense was going to use this strategy. So, in fact, they did call in the FBI, and they did run tests. Now, they did not test the crime scene blood swatches. That's a very important point for people to understand. They tested blood on Simpson's socks, found it at his home. That was a fairly prominent part of the case. And they tested blood that was on a back gate at the crime scene. They did not test those particular blood drops, 47 through 52, that I had referred to earlier. Now, interestingly enough, 3 months passed. The FBI, although the prosecution continued to put on their case, the FBI were never called as witnesses. In early May of 1995, Rodney Harmon again stood in front of the judge and talked about gas chromatography tests, the same thing I'd written about in the book proposal, the same thing I described to Carl Douglas 7 or 8 months earlier about how you find EDTA. He had the results of the FBI tests by that time, and he told the judge, outside of the presence of the jury, that yes, indeed, the defense did have what he called a sliver of hope based upon those test results, at which point the defense team burst into smiles because they knew that there was evidence from those two testings that something was in that blood.
And testimony, although the defense was not actually allowed to conduct their own independent test, but rather to observe the results. Is that correct?
Exactly.
And the individual who testified on behalf of the defense was an expert on EDTA, Dr. Jürgen Reegers.
Frederick Reegers, excuse me. A man from Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And he said, and I think I'm accurate, he said, you know, there's the strongest possible evidence. I think that's almost an exact quote.
That was an unfortunate slip on my part. That's actually a German Nazi attorney who's defended people associated, such as Gary Lauck, associated with some of these international Nazi networks that we'll touch on a little later. So that was a singularly unfortunate, no pun intended, mistake on my part. Frederick Reegers was the individual's name.
Reegers testified on behalf of the defense when they began putting on their case in July and said, based upon 40 years of experience of blood testing, and based upon looking at these test results, I conclusively believe that EDTA is in this blood. Now, as I said earlier, the prosecution did not call Roger Marks, the special agent who had conducted the test, but the defense did. And on direct examination, I believe with defense attorney Robert Blaser, he said, I have found something consistent with EDTA in these blood samples. Subsequently, Marsha Clark cross-examined him, and he began to change his testimony. But I think one could conclude from all of this that something was found. It's not even his testimony that is as important as the fact that the prosecution went out of their way, brought in the FBI, got the judge's approval, spent the public's money, conducted the test, and never called him as a witness. That tells you what you need to know about the blood in this case. Now, we do, as I said, the crime scene blood swatches, which is what I believe now should be tested. If that blood still exists and still could be tested, I believe it should be tested right now. And that's what one of the things I would like to see done. Because what happened is, as I said earlier, that swatches were collected from the crime scene. They were very fresh. It was probably 10 or 11 hours after the crimes on the morning of June 13th. Simpson came back from Chicago about noon or 1. He gave blood about 2 that afternoon. And these other swatches were already at the crime lab or were already in transit. When Dr. Lee testified, the essence of what he had to say was that testimony had come from prosecution witnesses that because the blood had been picked up early and placed in the packets that it was stored in, it was dry by the time it got to the lab, or it was dry at a given point in the lab. But when the defense looked at those same packets, they were wet. And Dr. Lee's famous pronouncement was, something's wrong.
I remember one of the prosecuting attorneys, I can't remember which one, made a statement saying in his cross-examination of Dr. Lee, isn't it true that the distinction between wet and dry is sort of fuzzy? And Dr. Lee looked at him and in his ever-gracious manner sort of told him where to get off. And he said, the distinction between wet and dry is not fuzzy at all, which I thought was a very dramatic and yet largely undercovered point in the trial.
And several jurors said, if you watch them in interviews, you know, after all this was over, they said Dr. Lee was the most impressive witness in the trial. I mean, he, like him or not like him, he did make a great impression on some of those jurors. But that was what he was, it was hard to follow some of what was being done in that trial, particularly on the part of the defense. But that was what he was getting at, was that those were not the same swatches.
There was one of the things, and we're going to talk about this more in a few minutes, Stephen. Racism pervaded all aspects of this trial, and in the many condemnations of the jury that took place in the media afterwards, the impugning of their intellect, and the supposition being that because they were black, they weren't smart enough to follow all this evidence, was one of the most pernicious, and yet Dr. Lee's testimony was among the most technically sophisticated, and they certainly appeared to be quite capable of not only grasping, but understanding the import of what he had to say.
If you listen to the jurors being interviewed after the verdict, they talked about the evidence. They did what they were there to do. They did what the public didn't do, what the media has never done, what the prosecution refused to do consistently throughout the entire trial. They dealt with the evidence. And when they talked, what did they talk about? I mean, the gloves didn't fit. They talked about EDTA. I was rather amazed that several came out and specifically focused in on it and said something was in that blood. They talked about the blood being missing from the vial. You know, the 8 cc's or milliliters were drawn from Simpson's arm, and there were only 6 There were only six later on. What happened to the other two? They talked about that. So I think it would not be a surprise to anyone to believe that there are policemen on the LAPD who have racist tendencies. I don't think they were shocked by that, and I think they were perfectly capable of convicting Simpson in spite of that. I don't think they acquitted him because of Furman. I don't think they acquitted him because of the Furman tapes. I think they acquitted him because they looked at the evidence and they could not come up with anything but reasonable doubt.
There appears to have been more than reasonable doubt about some aspects of the blood in the Bronco. Your source indicated to you that that was suspect as well, and some of the things that came out during the course of the trial tended to support that.
There were photographs. Barry Scheck is largely responsible for that, for some of the examination that went wrong with that. What happened was that, you know, the Simpson's truck was impounded on the 13th of June. It was taken to the fingerprint shed there at the LAPD, and they took photographs of it. And on the 14th or the 15th, whatever. But there was more blood, according to photographs and according to testimony, in the Bronco in August when they went back and took more samples than there was in mid-June. That's number one. Number two is that an LAPD detective, Kelly Moldorfer, who testifies for the defense, was inside the Bronco on the 13th or the 14th. She was a detective who was involved in some of the aspects of the case at that time. She was inside the Bronco. She testified. I didn't see any blood. There was no blood on the seats. There was no blood on the console.
This from an LAPD detective?
This from an LAPD detective. So it's... It really just doesn't add up, and it just never added up. And if they hadn't been so intent on solving this case in 2 or 3 days or 2 or 3 hours, perhaps, I think it would have gone in a very different direction, and I think they would have learned many, many other things.
Robert Shapiro, in his cross-examination of Detective Van Adder, also scored some points vis-a-vis Van Adder's initial written report of Blood in the Bronco. Could you tell us about that?
Well, the key thing with Van Adder, as we all know, is that he, which squares precisely with what I was told, was that he transported that blood, you know, back to Rockingham, and which was an outrageous thing to do, and which they never had any answer for. And I referred earlier to the two missing milliliters that... if they were, what I was told, and this has never been proven, it has never come out, you will not read it in any of the books, is that a syringe was inserted into that vial and blood was drawn out. And if you look at the blood drops, many of the blood drops associated with O.J. Simpson, they are very round, they are very neat, they are very symmetrical. They do not look like blood that has flown off of somebody running as fast as he can or something of that nature. The blood at his house and other blood looks like this.
We should note for formal legal purposes that no one has ever been charged with a crime of framing O.J.
Simpson.
No, that's
Simpson. True. That is very true.
Now, I also want to note, Stephen, that... one of the things Johnny Cochran pointed out was that the crime scene was broken down unusually quickly, and yet the blood sample from the back gate was taken months afterward.
The crime scene was broken down about 3:45 on that Monday, June 13th, which just seems extraordinarily fast. And then what happened later that day and later on was, you may have seen pictures of this on television, is that some of Nicole's friends, you know, went over there and washed all the blood off the pavement. Well, whose blood was it? I mean, there was enough blood there to cover, you know, Bundy Street,
mm-hmm.
and it's all gone. And when they tried to bring in scientific evidence that there was blood present that didn't belong to anybody, it was a very difficult thing to do. However, LAPD detectives again testified on behalf of the defense that there were 17 sets of fingerprints there that didn't belong to anybody. Whose are those? But the blood on the gate that you referred to was taken on July 3rd. The crimes were committed on June 12th. It was broken down the following day, as you said, in mid-afternoon. And the point being, why? How did that blood get there 3 weeks later?
Indeed. Not 3 weeks, but it was taken a long time. Not months, rather, but it was taken a long time after the crime scene was broken down. And that was a remarkably quick process. Stephen, in your book, you have a number of speculative elements from your source about what may actually have happened. And one of these concerned the possibility that the initial target of the killers, and I believe your source mentioned there were four at one point?
There have been more than one report of that. That is not unique to me.
Because I had never heard, a speculation. I personally, from the get-go, did not think that this was something that could have been committed by a single person in that time. And given the absence of marks and the absence of blood on O.J. in the timeline, I simply felt it was impossible. It was a fantastically bloody and violent struggle, and it just seemed preposterous to believe that one individual could have done that. I had not heard of any other. In your book, there's one passage where you discuss the possibility of four killers. I had not heard any of the other accounts. Could you enlighten us about those?
About what, I'm sorry?
About the other accounts of the possibility of more.
Well, there was the one woman who was going to testify to that, and she was more or less destroyed before she had a chance to do that, Marianne Gertrude. She did not prove to be a very credible witness.
She had some possible criminal charges.
Yeah, that was information that was reported at that time. There were several other people who talked about it. Pat McKenna, who was another leading investigator, was on Larry King about a week or so ago, and he was talking about witnesses that he has spoken with who also saw multiple people there, and he has tried to get this person to come forward and talk about it, and they simply will not do it. I mean, of all the very interesting things that have surfaced, you know, you've had several sort of public figures say, well, I'll give somebody $1 million if they'll just tell me who committed these crimes, as if it were that simple. Because if you start to think about, let's just speculate for the moment that O.J. Simpson didn't commit these crimes, and let's take the investigation in another direction. Let's do what the police didn't do. You know, this crime, they tried to solve this crime without ever conducting an investigation because an investigation was never done. There were two people at this crime scene. There were two victims, not just one. That has been overlooked entirely throughout the entirety of this case. That's number one. Number two, if someone had information, why wouldn't they come forward? What would be a possible answer to that question?
Well, obviously, the killers are still at large, and they won't exactly be doing the varsity rag at the thought of somebody ratting on them.
That's true.
And it would also appear, at least from a superficial standpoint, that whoever the killers were, they appeared to have a fair amount of, whoever the executive authority was in the killers, they appeared to have had a fair amount of clout, I guess one could say, in a general sense.
That's true.
You mentioned that your source informed you that, in all probability, or at least according to your source's information, that Nicole was not the original or main target of the killers.
I think it was something that has to be investigated, and it was never done. That's my overriding point. There was never a murder investigation done on this case. This case has been controlled by Mark Furman from the moment it began. That's why I presented the information to you as I have. We know from police officers going well back into his career that he had come forward and talked about Nicole Simpson. We know that he did not arrive at that crime scene as a blank slate. We know that he talked to Phillips about it on the way over there because there's testimony to that effect, that he knew what went on between these people. He has controlled this case from the instant it began. And he is, I think we could safely conclude, based upon what he has said about himself over the last 20 years, at best, disturbed. That is what has controlled the media's perception of this case. That is what has controlled the public's perception of this case. That is what has controlled the state of California's perception of this case. They have been wrong about Furman on every single count. I mean, they tried to set him up as not being a racist, and it failed miserably. And they have not yet come to grips with what this means. But the other part of the internal affairs investigation that I referred to a long time ago that was conducted in February of 1995 was that one of the original charges was that he was putting swastikas on the lockers of other policemen, particularly if they, as in one example, had a Jewish spouse.
That was a Detective Purdy.
That's correct. That when push came to shove, they did not want to deal with this either. And it was simply whitewashed and pushed under the rug, and Mr. Furman was allowed to go on and do his job, as he was for 20 years.
Weren't there initially reports that a check of fingerprints inside of Detective Purdy's locker confirmed that, at least according to the information presented in the report initially, Furman had actually done that?
That's correct.
That, again, has never been proved in any formal legal sense, so we should note that for formal legal purposes here.
That's correct.
Furman has never been charged with any kind of crime in connection with that, and we should emphasize that.
But now, he did perjure himself during the trial, and,
well,
and they have not confronted that either. And it's not so much a matter of saying everybody did everything wrong. I mean, I'd like to be very clear in saying this. If you don't start with the appropriate assumptions, and if you don't do the job you're paid to do, you're not going to end up in the right place. And that's what happened in this case. They simply did not do the work that they are paid to do.
Before we get to the performance, Stephen, I think of the media, of the defense to a certain extent, of the prosecution, beyond that of the society as a whole, because I think in many ways the real significance, not only of the O.J. Simpson case, but of the information that you have helped to throw, the light you have helped to throw on that, goes far larger than Mark Furman or any given participant or a series of participants in the case. But you mentioned in the course of your book that there was some information that connections in or around Aspen, Colorado may have played an important part in what transpired.
There is a Metzaluna restaurant in Aspen, Colorado, and there it was something that I tried to investigate somewhat on my own. Time and again in this particular case, I found myself with information that I couldn't do anything with. I did not have the resources to do a lot of things I wanted to do. I talked to a number of people in Aspen and basically got the door slammed in my face.
Right.
Nobody wanted to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's fairly obvious what the connections are. And every time I brought it up, I was told that we're just not going to talk about this in connection with the O.J. Simpson case.
So it certainly seems like there are people who know more than they're willing to talk about, and they, too, are afraid.
And those people were never questioned in a serious manner by the police. And that's the way you solve a crime of this nature.
Just one second, Stephen. One of the things that you brought out in your book, Stephen, and that we've already touched on in connection with the internal affairs investigation of Mark Furman, is the possibility of a structural link or a thematic link, perhaps we could say, between your first book, Talk to Death, and some of the forces that may have been involved in framing O.J. Simpson.
Well, what happened was that, as I point out in the book, is that I was given this information, but it was never made really clear to me why I was given it. For a considerable period of time, I was just told, here are pieces of evidence. See if this exists, and see if you can give this to the defense, and see if they can do anything with it. And that's about all I knew. I mean, I'd heard a lot of stories about Furman and read things in the New Yorker and other places, but I didn't know that much about him. In February of 95, about a week or so after the trial had started, as I write in the book, my wife was watching Good Morning America one morning. And I was upstairs working or doing something, and she came up and got me and said, "You better come down and watch this report on Furman." Furman had, as many of us know by now, had moved to Sandpoint, Idaho. Sandpoint, Idaho is where the murder weapon was found that killed Alan Berg. It was a known neo-Nazi enclave, at least in the mid-'80s it was, and had then become something of a retirement center for certain LAPD officers. Well, I thought this was certainly a curious coincidence that he would have ended up in the same place as the murder weapon. And then there were numerous media reports about that. So it became clear to me at that point why I had been given the information, that people inside the legal system knew that there are police officers who hold white supremacist beliefs, and they are extremely disruptive forces. And I think what you heard on the Furman tapes was precisely that.
There was a report in Newsweek magazine in the last week of March of 1995, that some fellow officers who'd been interviewed in connection with Mark Furman alleged that he was either involved with or the de facto head of a white supremacist group within LAPD called WASP, standing for White Anglo-Saxon Policemen.
Right.
That was in the those were in some of the files vis-a-vis Furman that Judge Ito would not permit to be introduced into evidence. As far as I know, there has never been any overt confirmation of those allegations.
No. But that is why I was involved in the case. I mean, it fits hand in glove with what I wrote about 10 years ago in the Alan Byrd case.
And that's, again, no pun intended.
Yeah, that's true. I would like to point out also that, just as a bit of an aside, that I have, after my book was published 3 or 4 months ago, I met a man named Donald Freed, who's written a number of books, and he has a book coming out about the O.J. Simpson case.
And by the way, he is a researcher whose work we have featured on this program before. I was not aware that you were in touch with him.
Yeah.
He's done some excellent work about the intelligence community and the JFK assassination.
If I could take a minute here, he called me out of the blue. I was not familiar with him. And I would like to point out that during the entirety of my involvement in the O.J. Simpson case, I was living in Denver. I was literally doing the best I could. I was not a part of the action here except in a very tangential sense. I did not have a staff working for me. I was completely self-employed, and there were a lot of things I couldn't do that I would have liked to have done. Mr. Freed has 6 people working on a book about the O.J. Simpson case. That book will be out in August or September. It's called Killing Time. It's published by Macmillan. And he is essentially going to go further down the road than I've gone in virtually every direction we're talking about. He has information in there about Furman's white supremacist connections that go far beyond what I've written.
All righty, Stephen, let's hold the discussion right there for a second. This is concluding this particular half-hour segment. We have been speaking with Stephen Singular, the author of Legacy of Deception, subtitled An Investigation of Mark Furman and Racism in the LAPD, published in softcover by Dove Books in 1995.